Welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now, whenever that now happens to be. The Healthy Planet radio show is a program of the nonprofit health and environmental education organization, Healthy Planet, and focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. What those of you listening to the radio in your car don't know is that this show is our holiday special live audience event, where we're not only broadcasting on 90.1 FM, but we're sitting here with a virtual audience. So welcome to all our listeners, both live and over the airwaves. We have a great experience coming for all of you. I think if you listen closely, your life might just be shifted. And I'm going to start this show by reading a short story that probably most of you have heard many times before, and which, as you'll see, perfectly reflects the work of the special guest I'm about to introduce in just a few moments. And the story goes like this. One day, a man was walking along the beach when he noticed a boy picking up and gently throwing things into the ocean. Approaching the boy, he asked, "Young man, what are you doing?" The boy replied, "Throwing starfish back into the ocean. The surf is up and the tide is going out. If I don't throw them back, they'll die." The man laughed to himself and said, "Do you realize there are miles and miles of beach and hundreds of starfish? You can't make any difference." The boy bent down to pick up another starfish and threw it into the surf. He smiled at the man and said, "I made a difference to that one." Now, this story is used to inspire people in social movements across the globe and, of course, speaks to the fact that while we can't necessarily affect sweeping change by taking one small action is important, both as a starting point and in that it can indeed make a difference to those who are impacted by that very one act. And this story fits our guest on today's show really well, since he inspired an international movement by caring for just one animal at a time in a world where billions are unnecessarily slaughtered for food on land and trillions at sea each and every year. And his organization, Farm Sanctuaries Actions, have spurred a movement of farm sanctuaries across the globe that are in turn each inspiring compassion in all who witness their work. His name is Gene Bauer, the president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary, which you'll learn a lot more about in the next 45 minutes to an hour. He's a best-selling author, has been hailed as the conscience of the food movements by Time Magazine, and named one of Oprah Winfrey's Super Soul 100 givers. He's a pioneer in the field of undercover investigations and farm animal rescue. Since the mid-1980s, he's traveled extensively, campaigning to raise awareness about the abuses of industrialized factory farming. He's visited hundreds of farms, stockyards, and slaughterhouses. His pictures and videos exposing factory farming cruelties have aired nationally and internationally, educating millions about the plight of modern farm animals. And his work has been covered by major media organizations, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, NPR, and the BBC. Gene, thank you so much for your work and for joining us on The Healthy Planet.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's great to be here. I love talking with folks about these issues, which, you know, too often people don't think enough about.
Indeed, they don't. And it would be tough to think about it enough because it's such an important issue. Really, if we were in our right minds, we'd be thinking about it every day, every minute. But here we are looking to get that transformation started. So, yes. Gene, start out by telling our audience about the history and mission of Farm Sanctuary.
So Farm Sanctuary was founded in 1986, and at the time we felt that we could change how people viewed and treated farm animals by exposing the cruelty these animals were enduring. So we spent days and weeks and months and years ultimately investigating factory farms, stockyards, and slaughterhouses to document conditions, to take pictures, to take videos. And the idea was, if we show people how bad this is, they're not going to want to support it. They will choose other things to eat. They will stop eating animals. It was a fairly idealistic, simplistic mindset, but that was what we started with. And as we went into these different places, we would find living animals literally thrown in trash cans or living animals left to die on piles of dead animals. So we started rescuing them. And we now operate sanctuaries in New York and California, but we also recognize that it's impossible to rescue all of the animals, the billions of animals who need to be rescued. And so we also work to educate people and advocate for reforms in our food system. Ideally, we would like to put our rescue work out of business. We would rather not have to continue rescuing animals, but we would like to continue living with these animals as our friends, not our food. And that is the message at the sanctuary. These animals are our friends, not our food. And each of us every day makes choices about how other animals experience the world and how they live and whether they suffer needlessly. And our food choices, you know, also affect our own health and the health of the planet. So what we eat every day has profound impacts on other animals and on ourselves. And it's something that I think it's important to talk about more and for people to think more about.
Indeed it is. So we've heard about Farm Sanctuary. Talk about how that mission translates into what happens on a day-to-day basis on the farm. What would people see? What are you doing on a day-to-day basis there?
Well, people visiting our sanctuaries would get a chance to see pigs rooting in the soil, pigs being pigs, pigs wallowing in the mud, interacting with their friends and being themselves. They would also see chickens, cows doing similar things, being themselves. And each has their own type of habitat, like cows like grazing. So they have a lot of pasture to graze on. Sheep like grazing as well. Goats prefer to browse. So we also try to provide enrichment so they can actually browse on brambles and on branches and look up to get things to eat. It's a sanctuary where animals get to enjoy life and where we as human beings have a chance to visit them. And seeing animals happy also helps to make us happy. And it's a very stark contrast from what happens at slaughterhouses, where you have animals who are stressed, where you have workers who are stressed, where you have violence and killing as part of the daily routine. At the sanctuary, the daily routine involves letting animals out of their barns in the morning, giving them food. If they're sick, giving them medication, checking on them regularly to make sure they're doing okay, and then also monitoring so that they continue to survive and to thrive and to have friendships with other animals, sometimes of their own species, sometimes of other species. So these animals are individuals who have likes and dislikes, and sometimes they really bond with another individual. So we try to monitor that and to watch for who gets along with who and create an environment where they're able to be with their friends and to thrive. Because just like all other animals and human beings, farm animals are social animals and very much affected by not only their environmental circumstance, but their social environment. And so we try to honor that. We also take care of animals who have been injured and abused and through the agribusiness industry. Sometimes they come to us with amputated limbs or with other disabilities, and we do everything we can to give them the best life possible.
That's fantastic. We so appreciate you doing that. And people can actually visit farm sanctuaries.
Yes, absolutely. We encourage people to come visit the sanctuaries. We have one in Watkins Glen, New York, just outside of Ithaca in the Finger Lakes region of New York. We also have a farm in Acton, California, just outside of Los Angeles. And these are places where we do tours. At our New York facility, we have overnight accommodations. We also do events at both the New York and California farms. And Farm Sanctuary is very different than animal agriculture in that we invite and encourage people to visit. In contrast to that, the factory farming industry wants to prevent people from visiting, and they've actually passed ag gag laws to make it difficult to investigate and see what is happening at these factory farm facilities. So sanctuaries are open to the public. We welcome people. We want people to visit and get to know these animals as friends, not food, as individuals with feelings, and to maybe give a pig a belly rub, for example. It's one of the highlights for many visitors. You know, we have 400 or 500 pound pigs, and you walk up to them in the barn, you touch their tummy, and they flop over for a belly rub because they enjoy it so much. We also have sheep that love to be petted by visitors, and they will paw at you very much like a cat or a dog. When you're petting them and you walk away, they paw at you to keep you petting them. We have sheep that do that as well. We have turkeys that sometimes will follow you around in the barnyard, just like a puppy dog. So these animals are not that different than cats or dogs. They are living, feeling creatures. They are individuals with personalities. Some are shy, some are more outgoing. And at Farm Sanctuary, they get to be themselves and they get to enjoy life, which again is a stark contrast from what happens in industry, where they're seen as commodities and then they're killed to be eaten. But there are friends at the sanctuary.
That's fantastic. And how many animals are at your different sanctuaries?
Between our farm in New York and California right now, we have about 700 animals, and all of them are individuals. And again, each one of them has their own life that they're experiencing, and we do everything we can to make sure that they have the best life possible.
That is an enormous endeavor. I'm not telling you. I'm just stating the obvious. I can't even imagine what it takes to house, feed, and care for all those animals, the veterinary bills, the lands, 24/7, 365. So kudos to you for having this last for so long. And farmsanctuary.org is the website?
That is correct, farmsanctuary.org.
And we'll be posting that in the chat box for those of you who are not on your computers right now and don't want to try and remember it. It will be put in the chat, as well as a link to Adopt a Turkey. As I mentioned, you were a pioneer in the field of undercover investigations and farm animal rescue, and that got the ball rolling. How did Farm Sanctuary actually begin? Where did the spark come from?
Well, you know, In college, I started learning about factory farming and learning about the harms of our animal-based food system. So I went vegan in 1985 and felt that more needed to be done. So we started investigating farms to document and expose cruelty and started rescuing animals. And that was really how it began. There was no long-term plan. There was no three-year plan. It was just, there's a concern here about these animals suffering. Let's document it. And then we would find animals that needed our help. And at the time, we were an all-volunteer organization. We had a very small budget. We were funded by selling vegan hot dogs out of our Volkswagen van at Grateful Dead shows. And we thankfully, over the years, have been able to continue doing this work thanks to the generosity of many supporters who make this work possible. And then also we have amazing people that work on the farms and work throughout the organization that care about these issues, and volunteers who have worked with us over the years as well. So we're grateful for such a community, which is how this work gets done.
So I've been doing this show since 2007, and I've never asked one of my guests this, but coming from a perspective of someone who really revels being in the presence of animals, how much do you love your work?
I love it, man. I do something I believe in. I wake up every day trying to make the world a kinder place. It's purposeful. It's meaningful. It can be challenging. We're up against an industry that is very powerful. And, you know, we care for about 700 animals. But if we even rescued 1 million animals a year, it would be a drop in the bucket. So we need to change the food system. And one of the things that gives me hope and makes me optimistic is the fact that each individual human being has an opportunity to make a positive difference. Many things in this world seem very distant or outside of our control, but when it comes to what we decide to eat, you know, each of us can do something every day. And by making more conscientious choices, eating plants instead of animals, supporting a food system that is not harmful, we can each make a difference. So this is a relevant topic for everybody. And that is something that gives me a lot of hope in terms of the possibility for creating change.
This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're talking to Gene Bauer, best-selling author, president, and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary that has locations both in New York and California. You can find out more about Gene and Farm Sanctuary at www.farmsanctuary.org. Farmsanctuary.org. Yeah, in a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to talk more about some of the joyful, hope-inspiring personal experiences that you have in working with individual animals of all kinds. I think that's really important. But before I do that, I'm going to ask you to describe some of the harsh realities that made it necessary for Farm Sanctuary to exist in the first place. And those realities are going on now every single day. You talk a lot about the global impacts of raising animals for food as a destructive force on everything from the environment and resources to workers who work in that field to the animals themselves. And it's really hard to get our mind around because the impact is so big. So let's take some of these issues one by one. I'm going to start by asking you to describe some of the actual impacts of our choice to eat animals on the animals. And please include in that take the truth behind the claims of happy cows, pigs, chickens being raised and slaughtered for food. And of course, people are told that because the people who are putting out those products want people to feel good about what they're eating.
Right. Well, these animals are treated like inanimate commodities more than like living, feeling animals. That's the first issue. And that goes across the board, whether we're talking about chickens or pigs or turkeys or cows, they are seen as objects, not individuals with feelings. And when there is this attitude of the commodification of sentient life, which is commonplace, you have practices that reflect it. So birds that are raised, chickens that are raised for meat, for example, have been genetically bred to grow four times faster than normal in order to reach market weight quickly. But this results in enormous pain and suffering for these individuals whose bodies are so heavy that their legs can barely support them. And so oftentimes they become crippled. They end up laying in litter that is soaked with ammonia that burns their skin. And of the animals killed in this country every year, the vast majority are birds, including chickens and turkeys. And they are exempted from the only federal law that protects farm animals. Mm-hmm. And that is, ironically, the Humane Slaughter Law. And, you know, so there's no laws that protect animals on farms, no federal laws. And the federal Humane Slaughter Law exempts 95% of the animals killed every year in slaughterhouses. In the case of turkeys, they've also been genetically bred to grow faster and larger than normal, and they suffer because of their heavy bodies. They've also been so profoundly altered genetically that they can't even reproduce naturally anymore. So they are all products of artificial insemination. So that's a little bit of an overview of the chickens and turkeys who make up the vast majority of animals killed in this country. Because they're smaller and there's less meat on their bones. So when it comes to cows, there's a lot more weight there. And so killing one animal results in a lot more meat, but these animals also suffer. And not only cattle in the beef industry, but particularly animals in the dairy industry. Oftentimes people who care about animals decide not to eat them because they don't want to support slaughter and the violence that entails. But sometimes they still eat dairy products thinking, oh, these cows aren't dying, so it's not so bad. Well, in fact, dairy cows, when they're no longer productive, are in fact slaughtered for beef, but they suffer for years before that. For a cow to produce milk, just like any other mammal, they have to be impregnated and give birth. So dairy cows today have a calf every year, and the calf is taken away from them right at birth so that that milk can be taken and sold to human consumers. The baby calves, if they're female, are raised to become milking cows, but the male calves are useless to the dairy industry. So the veal industry was created to use all of these unwanted male calves born on dairy farms. So it's accurate to say that the veal industry was literally born out of the dairy industry. And it was done again to take advantage of all these unwanted male calves. So a cow, and a year in the life of the dairy cow go something like this. January 1st, they give birth. The baby's taken away. For the next couple of months, they're giving milk. And then at about 2 or 3 months into their lactation cycle, they're re-impregnated. So for the next 7 months, so the cows have a 9-month gestation period. For the next 7 months, they're producing milk at an intense rate, about 10 times more than normal. So their body is in a state of negative energy balance, and they're losing weight because they cannot keep the weight on their bodies because they're producing so much milk and they're pregnant. 2 months before giving birth, they stop milking them so they can be reconditioned in the parlance of the dairy industry. In other words, put more weight on them so when they give birth the next year, that they have enough weight to go through the cycle again and to live another year in negative energy balance, producing more milk than they're intended to produce while being pregnant for most of that time. And so these animals will only last about 3 years in production before they're sent to slaughter. And in a natural environment, a dairy cow could live 20 years. So that's just an example of how these dairy cows suffer. In the pig industry, you have factory farms where you have breeding sows, the females, that are kept in gestation crates. It's called a gestation crate because it's where these mothers are kept during their gestation period or their pregnancy, which is about 4 months. Then right before giving birth, they move them into a farrowing crate, which is similarly restrictive, but there's a little space on the side for the piglets to nurse on the mother. And they'll be there for about 2 weeks before the piglets are taken away and the mother is re-impregnated, put right back in the gestation crate to continue the cycle. So it's gestation crate to farrowing crate, to birth, to nursing, to impregnation again, gestation crate, farrowing crate, birth. Again, it's a cycle. And these animals only live a few years through that as well because they're pushed so hard. The piglets that are born in these facilities are taken and raised for slaughter in factory farms where they're crowded by the thousands. And they are usually killed at about 6 months old. So we're killing very young animals. 6 months for pigs. In the case of chickens, it's like 6 weeks. And because they've been genetically bred to grow so fast and so large, they were killing babies. And they also start having difficulties genetically as they get bigger because they've been bred specifically for fast growth and certain muscle. Chickens and turkeys, for example, have been genetically bred to have large breasts because that's the most profitable meat. And so they're anatomically manipulated in ways that are also not good for their well-being. So this is an industry that, again, sees these animals as nothing but commodities and does not protect them from egregious cruelty. This industry is exempt from most humane laws at the state level. There's no federal law that applies to farm animals on farms. And as I mentioned earlier, the only federal law addressing the humane treatment of farm animals is ironically the Humane Slaughter Act, and it exempts chickens and turkeys, which are the vast majority of animals killed.
And that term itself is worthy of a whole discussion. Humane slaughter.
Yes, it is. Yeah, the word humane and the word slaughter really don't go together.
They don't. No, in no universe, no way we could possibly get our minds around to do those fit together.
Yeah.
But it exists as a term. And it actually lures people into purchasing things that they might otherwise not if they were looking at the picture without some of those euphemisms.
And then in talking about labeling, there's also now with growing awareness about the cruelty of factory farming and the mistreatment of animals, there's been an effort on the part of agribusiness to make conditions sound better than they are. You know, using terms like cage-free or free-range or free-roaming, you know, on the surface, that sounds really good. But those terms are more about marketing and promotion and increasing the price, frankly, and less about describing the real conditions. And agribusiness has a vested interest in making things sound better than they are. So it's important for consumers to be mindful of these labels and recognize that they're not generally accurate and they are misleading more times than not.
Yeah, indeed. And those facts just that you mentioned before about most of the animals that we're killing are actually very young. Our society, we love puppies and kittens and young animals, young creatures. People don't understand that. Many, many people, I should say, do not understand the fact that these cows and pigs are impregnated so frequently, and that the only way to get the milk from these poor creatures is to keep them impregnated repeatedly throughout their lives. That in itself, I've heard people listen to that one fact who have changed like that after hearing it because they just didn't understand it, because we're not led to a place to think about it frequently enough, which is what you're in the business of doing.
Exactly. And we also don't recognize or think enough about the fact that cow's milk is for baby cows. You know, we are human beings and cow's milk is not that well suited to us at all. And it creates all kinds of health problems.
Indeed. And when we hear about a lot of these facts about the babies being killed in the gestation crates and the veal and all that, we cringe and we say, okay, I don't want to hear about that. I'd rather not hear about it. What we have to keep in mind is that there are people working in these industries who need to deal with it every single day because they have very few choices and they're forced to work in this industry. So talk a little bit about the impact on these workers and the communities that are involved in raising these animals that we put our money down to purchase.
Yeah, that's a really important point. You know, slaughterhouses and factory farms are dangerous, stressful, unhealthy places to work. During COVID, many slaughterhouse workers were made sick by the virus. And rather than saying, okay, let's take time off, these workers were forced to go to work. And the slaughterhouse owners were given a break in terms of not being liable for the workers' illnesses. And so that really speaks to the power dynamic where you have workers who have very little power. Right now we have an outbreak of avian influenza across this country because factory farms are disease-ridden. And the first human where avian influenza affected and infected a human being was a worker at a factory farm with birds, and this worker was an incarcerated person. So agribusiness also exploits workers who don't have their freedom, literally. And so you have this industry that's all about extraction and exploitation and does not respect animals or workers. It also is very bad for people who live near factory farms. In North Carolina, for example, you have these pig factories that are creating waste lagoons, they call them, but they're basically cesspits full of liquid manure. And this is sprayed into the air onto neighboring fields, and it gets onto neighbors' houses and their property. And these neighbors have tried for decades to prevent this from happening, but the industry has gotten away with it. And again, they're very powerful. They're connected politically. And it's just another example of the injustice and the abuses that those with power are able to get away with. So our food choices are, you know, affect other animals, but they also affect other people, whether they're people that work at these places or people who have to face the pollution of the factory farms in their communities. And it's not something any of us needs to be part of. And unfortunately, when people do work in these places, it has an effect. And many times people who work in these places don't feel like they have many other options. So they end up stuck in this. And it's a tragedy for all involved. And so I think we need to create systems and structures and opportunities to produce food in a healthy way without causing unnecessary violence and killing of other animals, and where people are paid fairly for their work, which is another problem here, and are protected from injuries and protected from illnesses. But that's not the case in factory farms.
The abuse does not stop at the animals.
No, it does not. At the non-human, it affects all the animals, human and non-human.
Right? Human and non-human. Yes, exactly. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're talking to Gene Bauer, best-selling author, president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen, New York, as well as in California. And Farm Sanctuary is not only a movement and online destination, but you can visit the farm and revel in the presence of hundreds of rescued farm animals. You can find out more about Gene and Farm Sanctuary at www.farmsanctuary.org. That's farmsanctuary.org. Gene, I saw you on the Jon Stewart show some years ago, and he said something to the effect that going vegan seems to be the solution to the health issues, the climate change, etc. But on the other side, there's corned beef. Right. And it was a humorous moment where he was saying that despite all of these horrible problems that are coming from these animals and the suffering with the animals and everything, the taste can trump that. However, we're in a different world now. And yeah, that different world where there are meats that are plant-based and they're getting better every year. Do you share my sentiment that the rise of these plant meals is a transformative event that will take everything you and I and all the other people working in this movement have done over the past 50 years and just make it explode in the possibilities that it can create?
Yes, I think that these alternatives to meat that basically mimic meat, even like the Impossible Whopper at Burger King, can play a major role in making plant foods much more accessible to a wide audience. And so I think that's a very, very positive development. I think that, you know, on the Jon Stewart show also, he sort of joked about loving Beiko so he could never go vegan. And I was really happy to say that, well, actually, Beiko's are vegan. So there's a lot of products that are already vegan that people don't even know about. And sometimes people say, I can't eat vegan food. And you might want to ask, hey, have you ever had an apple? So there's all kinds of food. Most of the food in the world is vegan. And historically, you know, most ethnic foods have been plant-based because plant production is much more efficient than animal production. And, you know, it's usually the wealthy and the elite who eat meat, and it comes with power and reflects power. And so I think, you know, what we decide to eat is a bigger reflection of who we are and what we consider our place to be on the planet. Are we entitled to kill other animals to eat them is sort of a fundamental question. And when we ask people to consider not eating meat, sometimes I think there's a sort of subconscious opposition to it, thinking, well, you're taking away my power. But in fact, I think by eating plants instead of animals, we empower people to live in alignment with their own values, with their own interests, to live in a way where they're eating food that is nourishing instead of eating food that makes us sick, which is what we're doing today, or supporting a food system that's destroying the planet, which is what we're doing today, and killing animals and mistreating them in a way that is that undermines our humanity. So there are so many things about this. And, you know, like Jon Stewart said, there's this one choice we can make not to eat animals, and it has all these benefits. Animal agriculture contributes to so many of our environmental problems today, including the loss of biodiversity, the climate crisis. It's a greater contributor to the climate crisis than the entire transportation industry. It uses up vast amounts of land, so we're destroying ecosystems. In the United States, 10 times more land is used for animal agriculture versus plant-based agriculture, for example. And so it requires so many more resources. And the bottom line is that we can feed more people more efficiently with less land and fewer resources by eating plants instead of animals.
It's very clear. And if we had more hours, I would ask you to go into some of those topics, but we don't. What I'd like to do now is shift to my favorite part of your topic, which is the animals. This is a holiday show, and we want our audience to feel good about what they're hearing and to deeply feel and understand the amazing work that Farm Sanctuary is up to. And toward that end, I'm going to ask you to tell some stories about individual animals that you've known and interacted with through the years, because I think your perspective and stories on this are so important, because many people in the U.S. are simply, and around the world, are simply not able to relate to the animals they're currently eating. They see their cats and dogs and fish and whoever else they live with as very close relationships that they love, care for deeply. But the vast majority of us have never interacted with the animals that they eat. And so having that perspective, that verbal introduction to chicken, cow, turkey, sheep, other animals that you've known, Talk about their personalities, things they do, their ways of being, their names, things that make them unique, whatever else that you think of that in your long experience with all of these animals.
Yeah, so one of the stories I like to tell is Opie, who is a calf that I found left for dead at a stockyard. And he was sent to the stockyard on the day he was born. He was still wet from afterbirth. He was born on a dairy farm and he was an unwanted male. So he was shipped there on his birthday, fell. It was a freezing day and he was dying of hypothermia. And so I asked the stockyard worker, what's happening with this calf? And he said, I've got to bury him later today. And I said, what if I take him off your hands? And he said, sure, go ahead. So I took the calf to a nearby veterinarian to see if he could make it. And she said that this calf had very little chance of survival, that he should just be euthanized. And it didn't make any economic sense. And I said to her that I wanted to do what I could for him. And to me, it was not about economics. If he was able to live a good life, I wanted to give him a chance. So she gave him the treatment he needed. I brought him back to the sanctuary. And, you know, when I first brought him back, he was practically comatose. He couldn't lift his head, but he was on intravenous fluids. And then the light started coming into his eyes. He was able to lift his head. Mm-hmm. He was able to nurse from a bottle and then to stand. And I was feeling really good about his recovery and about his improvement, but he wasn't thriving. And I was worried that there was something wrong. And I kind of wondered to myself, what's going on here? Why is Opie not doing well? And it dawned on me that he needed to be with other cows. He needed to be with his people. He needed social experience. So I brought him out to the cow barn, put him in a pen. All the other cows gathered around. They started mooing to him. He started mooing back and sparked up and began thriving. And he had a long life with us. He lived to be close to 20 years old and weighed close to 3,000 pounds. Wow. So this is an individual who was written off as dead, was considered to be not worthy of it, of care, because he didn't make sense economically, but he grew, he thrived, and he was a gentle presence in the barn, and really loved going out there and seeing him there in his healthy state and being giant. I mean, when he stood in the barn, it's like 10 by 10 doors. When he stood in the door, he occupied most of it. You know, he was huge, which is one of the amazing things that happens too at the sanctuary, is that these animals are allowed to grow old. And as a result, they become their full selves. And sometimes they become very big, like happened with Opie.
And you have to feed them.
Yes, we do. We do. Yes. And
that's just amazing.
Yeah. So they, you know, they eat a lot, and but they have a good life up there. And just being able to spend time with them and to know where they came from and to watch these animals heal also helps us to heal. Seeing cruelty and violence day after day in the factory farming system is really difficult. And the sanctuaries actually grew out of our desire to do something positive in the midst of this violent factory farming system. I'm not on the farm on a daily basis now, so I don't know many of the individuals who are there, but I remember Hilda, you know, who was our first rescued animal. She was a sheep that we rescued off the dead pile, and she was pretty shy. So she generally didn't like to, you know, run up to people. Like some of the sheep we have now will actually run up to people, but Hilda kept her distance. But her friend Jellybean was more outgoing. And so they were always together. And when Jellybean would approach people and come closer to people, you could see Hilda feeling a little bit more comfortable around people too. You know, so again, these are social animals. They're very, very much influenced by those around them. And that's part of what happens at the sanctuary. Animals who come from the factory farming system are usually very afraid of people, because all they've ever experienced has been violence or pain. And so when they first come to the sanctuary, I think they're a little bit afraid of people. But as they see other animals not afraid of people and other animals enjoying themselves and not living in fear, I think our new arrivals understand that they're in a safe place and that they don't have to be afraid anymore. And so that's one of the most beautiful things that happens at the sanctuary, is that it's a place where animals don't have to be afraid.
That's so nice to hear. So good to hear, because so many of us have chosen never to eat them again because we don't want this to happen. And then to know that these few souls, you know, the starfish, are being treated and respectfully and cared for, it's just very good to see.
You're listening to WUSB 90.1 FM and the Healthy Planet radio program with Gene Bauer of Farm Sanctuary. I'm going to hand it off now to Catherine Congdon, also of Healthy Planet, for a couple of audience questions.
So we'll just move to some of the questions that we have. And thank you again for being here. Just everything that you've talked about, so compelling. And I hope more people get to hear this radio show and just see just how far-reaching all of this is on so many levels. Okay, so one of the questions is, can you tell us about the baby male chicks? What happens to them after hatching?
Yes. In the poultry industry, there are two distinct kinds of birds. There are the meat-type chickens that have been genetically bred to grow fast and large to be used for meat. And then you have your egg-laying breeds of chickens who've been genetically bred to not grow very fast or very large, but to put all of their feed energy into egg production. So at hatcheries that hatch out egg-laying hens, you have males and females that hatch. The males will never lay eggs, and they don't grow fast enough to be raised profitably for meat. So they're literally killed the day they hatch. And I've been to hatcheries. I've seen dumpsters full of these unwanted male chicks. I've also seen them killed by egregious methods. And they're just discards of the industry, basically. And so this is just one other example of how, although eggs may seem less bad than meat in some ways, in other ways, they can even be worse. And hens that are laying eggs have historically been confined in these battery cages where they're confined so tightly they can't even stretch their wings. So you have this industry that is, you know, is harmful in ways that we don't even see. Not only the egg-laying hens, but the unwanted male chicks who are thrown away at the hatcheries.
Yeah, it's really, really tragic. Are there any laws that we can institute on the state level? I know New York is a big dairy state, so there'd be a lot of pushback, but is there anything in the works right now people could push for?
Yes. Over the years, we've worked on various laws to prohibit some of the worst cruelties, the most intensive confinement of animals, such as packing animals in cages and crates where they can't even stretch their wings. We've had some success with that. We've also been able to enact some laws to prevent downed animals, animals too sick to walk, from being dragged onto trucks and taken to slaughter. But most humane laws are not applied to farm animals. And so we still have a lot of work to do. And in New York State, in addition to working to strengthen humane laws, we're also now working to change agricultural laws to incentivize healthier community-oriented plant-based agriculture instead of factory farm consolidation. And so there are government programs that have been intended for good purposes, like farmland preservation, for example. But factory farms have been very clever about exploiting those laws and those programs to get money that's being used to consolidate the factory farm industry. And that's not the intent of these laws. So we're now trying to shift these laws and introduce new legislation that would make sure that this money goes to help dairy farms, for example, to transition into a healthier, more sustainable plant-based business. Because the dairy industry in New York State is really struggling. Small dairies have been pushed out of business by the larger dairies, and these smaller dairies need an off-ramp. They need new opportunities and alternatives. And that's the type of policy we're working on in New York State.
Are there any bills in particular that you could tell us the numbers of, or it's not gotten to that point?
Yes, there was a bill introduced by Senator Brisport, the Farmer Opportunity Bill. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but if you looked up Senator Brisport Farmer Opportunity Bill, that was introduced this last year. We're getting kind of towards the end of this current legislative session, but we expect that it will come back again next year.
That's great. We can look that up and we can share it on the Facebook page. Because, you know, every voice counts, right? We have enough voices get together. So how many different species do you have? And is it only farm animals?
Yeah, at Farm Sanctuary, we generally take care of the animals that are considered to be consumables, the most abused. And so we started by rescuing chickens and cows and pigs and turkeys, and that's still pretty much the case. Although occasionally we'll get other animals, you know, like donkeys, for example, or horses or llamas. But most of the animals that we have been rescued out of the food industry. And, you know, we were created to help the largest number of animals who have the least protection. So those are farm animals.
Okay, great. Can you give us some ways to communicate with friends and family and coworkers who might not want to hear about any of this, if you have some advice for us?
I think it's important always to be kind and to recognize that sometimes people have habits that cause harm, and that they may even feel uncomfortable about these things. And I think one of our most important values at Farm Sanctuary is to speak to people where they are on their own journeys and to celebrate incremental steps, even small steps, towards living more consciously and more compassionately. So rather than judging people, I think it's important to try to support people and support positive steps. And one of the most, I think, impactful tools we have is food. Bring yummy vegan cupcakes or other tasty vegan food to gatherings and to family events, and just show people how tasty it is. And that sometimes will help get over certain obstacles. When people try this food, I think it gives people confidence and hope that they can actually eat vegan food and enjoy it. One of the obstacles I think many people have is they don't think they're going to like the food and afraid they're going to be giving it up. But if you can show people that this vegan food is really tasty and satisfying, it makes it a lot easier for them to hear about the other issues and the cruelty, for example, that they might not otherwise want to hear.
Yes, I've definitely found that with my loved ones, that bring something that's really delicious and, you know, maybe there's hope.
Yes, I think always hope and opportunity and possibility. You know, if somebody doesn't feel like they can do something positive, right? If somebody feels like they have no choice and they're supporting this horrible abuse, they don't want to hear about the abuse. But if they believe that they can do something about it, or they can live in a way that is not contributing to that abuse, I think there's hope and possibility and a much more open mind to hearing about the problems.
Right. And like you say, celebrate small steps. We were all unaware at one point, right?
Yes, exactly. Every step is worth celebrating, and small steps often lead to bigger steps.
I'll ask one more question here. What do you say to farm families who primarily raise soy, corn, and cattle? How can they transition to other crops or farm products, and what crops would you recommend?
Well, I think now with more plant-based meats, they're using a lot of pea protein. So I think there's opportunities to transition some of these feed crop acres into food crop acres for human consumption. And human foods usually sell for more than animal feed. So I think it's a win-win. And you can also add additional value by doing it organically. So soy can be used for tofu as well, or even better than it could be used for feed. Corn also can be used for human food. You know, it doesn't have to be for animal food. There's all kinds of different legumes or pulses or grains. And then there's fruits and vegetables and nuts. So there's an enormous variety. A lot of it depends on where somebody is located and what the local market demands, what the opportunities are. Where we are in upstate New York, there's actually a demand for garbanzo beans, of all things. So there's opportunities for farmers to be growing garbanzo beans. And so a lot of this depends on local markets and local opportunities.
Well, I happen to love garbanzo beans myself. I eat a lot of those.
As do many of us.
we're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes, the radio broadcast part of the show. So, Gene, you've been doing this for decades now, and you've got a good handle on the pulse of society, where we've been, where we're going. Do you see a big difference? And do you think that society's attitudes are moving in a direction where we could end up where Commander Riker on Star Trek, where he said that we no longer enslave animals for food purposes? This is in 2364. Do you think we're heading there in reality at some point?
I would love to believe that. And I think there are some indications that that's possible. I think that we have a sort of bimodal food system shift underway right now. You have your mass production side of it, where you have, you know, the plant-based meats and replacing animal products at fast food restaurants. And then you also have a more community-oriented small farm approach. And this also involves things like urban agriculture, where people are growing food in urban settings, where people are, in some cases, changing their lawns into becoming vegetable gardens. There's a whole food, not lawns movement. And in this country, we have something like 40 million acres in lawns. And that's more land than we use to grow fruits and vegetables. So, and sometimes people don't think we can produce a lot of food in these small plots. But in fact, during World War II, Victory Gardens produced like 40% of our produce. So it is possible to produce a lot of food in local areas and have that accessible to people and to large populations that need healthy, fresh produce. So there's a movement of mass production and also of local production. And both present opportunities to go more plant-based.
I just want to ask you quickly, when did you get, like, when you were 20 years old, what did you expect to be doing in life? And how does it differ?
Yeah, I this was obviously not on the chart as a possibility. It was, I grew up in LA, Hollywood, California, and I was always encouraged to be an engineer or, you know, get a job and make money. But I also saw a lot of harm being done in the world. And it just bothered me, you know, and I didn't want to be a cog in a wheel of a system causing so much harm. So I started volunteering, like in high school and college, with environmental groups, with human rights groups, and I started learning about factory farming. I worked at Greenpeace in college for a bit, and so with some Ralph Nader consumer organizations. And the more I learned, the more it became apparent that factory farming was horrible for animals, for the earth, for workers, for consumers. And I also learned I didn't have to eat animals to survive, which was news, because I grew up believing that's what you had to do. So I went vegan in 1985, and so I was 23, and then co-founded Farm Sanctuary in 1986. And we didn't have this long vision, like I mentioned. We just, you know, wanted to expose this cruelty. And so we started visiting these places and finding animals that were left for dead. We started rescuing them. And then it just grew, you know, and it's continued to grow. And it's beautiful to see so many sanctuaries now around the world. I think it's important, though, for sanctuaries not to get over our heads, because that's a very easy thing to do. So I think the instinct, the inclination is beautiful to rescue animals, and we need to manage it so we don't get over our heads. So I think as the sanctuary movement grows and matures, I think maybe there's going to be sort of more internal conversations like protocols, SOPs, all this kind of stuff to make sure that folks don't get overwhelmed, because, you know, some sanctuaries have gotten overwhelmed and have to say no sometimes, which is not an easy message, but it's critical.
I can understand that. You've told us a lot about Farm Sanctuary, and I think all of us have gotten an idea of the enormous endeavor it is to do what you're doing. So with that said, tell people how they can support you.
Well, people can go to our website, farmsanctuary.org. There's information there about donating, including adopting animals. People can come visit the farm. People can come stay overnight at our accommodations in Watkins Glen, New York. And people can sign up to receive updates from us with information about who you can contact in government, for example, to support legislation that we're working on. So check out our website, farmsanctuary.org. Also sign up for our Twitter account, Instagram, share information from us with your friends and family.
Any other thoughts you'd like to leave our radio audience with?
I think it's just important to recognize that our food choices have profound consequences on ourselves, other animals, and the planet. And this is something each of us can be conscious of and try to make healthier and kinder choices. And it's also important to recognize that farm animals, like all animals, have feelings and they deserve to be treated with compassion. And when we're kind to other animals, we don't only help other animals, we help ourselves.
Thank you so much for that. Gene, I appreciate everything you're doing.
I'm not going out on a limb by saying so many of us
are so appreciative of not just your work, but all the people who work at Farm Sanctuary. And we hope you continue your work and we hope to support you in doing that work.
Thank you very much. We'll keep doing it. We'll keep at it. And thank you for what you're doing as well.
Of course. There's no other thing to do. And it's our pleasure to do it.
And that'll do it for this evening's show. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. We've been talking to Gene Bauer, B-A-U-R, best-selling author, president, and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen, New York, and also in California. And Farm Sanctuary is not only a movement and online destination, but you can visit the farm and revel in the presence of hundreds of rescued farm animals that are treated with dignity, respect, and compassion. You can find more about Gene and Farm Sanctuary at www.farmsanctuary.org. That's www.farmsanctuary.org. I'll be with you again at this same time, unless we're preempted, which is happening now with some of the sports programming, on the first two Fridays of the month at 6 p.m. And when I'm not here, stay tuned to hear more excellent natural alternatives programs with the likes of Dr. Z, Eugene Zamperone, Jennifer Green, Courtney Bozick, and John Scardina every Friday at this time. For more info on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or to be part of our occasional live virtual audience for shows like this, email us at info@healthyplanetusa.org. That's info@healthyplanetusa.org. You can also visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org and like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong. Relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four and multi-legged friends. Consider having a holiday meal or a holiday day or a holiday week that doesn't rely upon doing something harmful to an animal. And finally, remember to enjoy each moment of existence on this beautiful planet that we all share. Good night.
But sometimes when I am feeling so grand, and I become the world, and the world becomes a man, my song becomes a part of the river. I cry out to keep me just the way I am, according to plan.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends. In English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes
me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. And in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The only thing I didn't learn in school today...
The only thing I didn't learn...
is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
This is the sound of a brand new outdoor grill being hurled off a 20-story building. Now a stylish glass coffee table. An electric guitar. These are the things you could enjoy all cast into oblivion. Because when you throw away money on wasted electricity, you throw away everything you could have bought with it. Visit EnergySavers.gov and get tips on how to save energy and money. Then do things like switch to Energy Star light bulbs or Energy Star appliances, and you could save hundreds of dollars a year. So this doesn't happen to the recliner you've had your eye on, or this to the treadmill on your wish list, or this to the shiny new bike your kid's been asking for. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at EnergySavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.